Symmetric group, H theory of symmetric group market.
Thank you. Well, first of all, having the chance of being the first speaker, I want to thank everybody who made this meeting possible. And, of course, as far as I'm concerned, Gordon for asking me to come. And after saying that, I'll show you here what I'm going to talk to you about and try to explain a little bit why gauge theories of the symmetric group. Oh, by the way, that's the reference of the paper we published already. Well, not published, because we're still trying to hear something from the referee. It's quite a long time. and some of it is still in progress. While looking at the gauge theory of the symmetric group, well, first of all, because it's an interesting problem, and also one tries to do things one succeeds to do, so that's a good reason. The second reason, well, the other reasons why this theory might be interesting is that it's in some loose sense related to string theory, in the sense that the gauge theory of the symmetric group describes the coverings of a Riemann surface. We are working in two dimensions. They are related to some quite known complex metric models. I'm talking about the Kostos, Staudacher, and Winter model. And also, this is more from a, if you want, from a statistical mechanics or mathematical point of view. We will show, in fact, this is one of our results, that they are equivalent to the problem of random walks on the symmetric group, and also to the problem of random graphs. So there are three different approaches: random graphs, random walks, and gauge theories that somehow come together. They are equivalent to each other, and they're just the same problem formulated with different language. And as we'll see, some things that are easy to calculate in one way, they are not easy to calculate in the other way, so these approaches can be complementary if one wants to get some results. Now, what I'm planning to say, my program is first to present what I mean by gauge theory of the symmetric group, show briefly what's the relation of these theories with the coverings of the Riemann surface. Then, of course, I'll go to the main part of the talk, which is to calculate the large end limit of these theories and see what comes out of it. And then, if I have time, which I hope I will, I would like to show what's the connection with the matrix models that I mentioned here, and also the equivalence with these other things here. So that's basically what I'm going to talk about. Now, let me first thing show you what the model's like. You are in two dimensions. You are on a Riemann surface. You do a cell decomposition of the Riemann surface, and you define the lattice gauge theory in the standard fashion. That is, you associate to each link a permutation, an element of the symmetric group. To each plaquette, the plaquette variable defined in the usual way as a product of all the links. And then you associate to each plaquette a Boltzmann weight, which is a class function, is invariant under gauge transformation, essentially. Sorry, it's not very... The green doesn't show very well. At the end of the game, the theory is obviously defined by the partition function, which is the product over all plaquettes of the Boltzmann weights. And to characterize the theory, you need to make a choice for this Boltzmann weights. I mean, depending, according to the choice you make, you can have different types of theories. Now, before going into the details of the theory, I would like straight away show you how discussing the coverings of a Riemann surface, you end up with the gauge theory of the symmetric group. Now, again, you start from a target space, which is a Riemann surface of a certain genus. And what is a covering? Well, a covering means that you have a world sheet that wraps n times around this surface. And so it covers the surface n times. The crucial point is that there is no fold allowed, so you can't just fold your world sheet like that. It has to go smoothly without folds, which is the reason why the area is exactly n times the area of the target space. The sheet can have branching points, in principle. Branching points are points where these sort of things happen, like the two sheets of a Riemann surface of a square root function. And given the number small p of the branch points, then the genus of the world sheet has this simple relation with the genus of the original Riemann surface. Now, the problem of counting the coverings is given the genus G, the area N of the world sheet, and the number of branch points, how can we count how many coverings you have? In other words, how many string configurations? Because in two dimensions, the only thing that the string can do is to go around the surface, and so counting the distinct coverings is the same thing as counting the string configurations. And other thing, how this problem is related to a gauge theory of the symmetric group. Now, here is the answer to the last question. Suppose here is your Riemann surface. Take a point P on the Riemann surface. Then on the world sheet, this point will have n images, because the world sheet wraps n times around the surface. And we call these images pi I, with I that goes from 1 to n. Now, take a loop, a closed loop, like this one, and I'm choosing in this case a loop which is non-contractible to a point. As you go around the loop, the n images can be subjected to a permutation. And so we can associate to this loop gamma a permutation Q gamma. If the loop is contractible, like for instance if a chosen loop that just goes a little loop around the point P, then if you don't have any branch points, like it would be like going around the pages of a book. Every page goes back to itself, because in principle, there are no branch points in the pages of the book, if the book has been done properly. And then, if you go around gamma, all the sheets will go back to themselves, so the permutation will be the identical permutation. But if there are branch points inside gamma, then, again, you can have a permutation of the sheets. Now, it's clear from what I said here that counting the number of coverings ends up being the same thing as considering a gauge theory of the symmetric group, because the whole point here is to any closed loop gamma is associated an element of the symmetric group in the same way as in the Gauss theory to any Wilson loop is associated an element of the corresponding Gauss group. And so if you take this surface and now you make a triangulation of this surface, you associate to each link of the triangulation a permutation, and you make the Gauss theory of such thing, then you end up exactly with this kind of this kind of a problem. The last thing I want to mention in this respect is that if you take the extreme case where no branch point is allowed at all, then if no branch point is allowed, any time you have a loop which can be contracted to a point, then to that loop is associated to identical permutations, and so the distinct coverings can be associated only to are associated to the correspondence to the homeomorphisms between the elements of the homotopy group of the surface and the permutation group. The easiest case of this situation is the case of a torus, which I can write as a square with the opposite size identified. Then the only two elements of the homotopy group of the torus are the two loops, the one goes this way and the one goes this way, which are this and this, in if you write it on the square. And so I associate an element Q of the symmetric group to this loop here, an element P of the symmetric group to this thing here, with, of course, the relation, if I go around the square, I have to go back to the original point, so that PQ, P minus 1, Q minus 1 equal 1. And so the coverings of the torus are all pairs of permutations that satisfy this this relation. Sorry? Yeah, the homotopy group. I mean the path which are topologically equivalent to each other. Okay.
And then if your loop just goes around through a branch cut and back, but not around the branch point, same thing.
If
your loop is an element of one of the homotopy.
Yeah. Okay. Now, coming back to the gauge theory, in order to specify the theory, we still had to specify the Boltzmann weights associated to the plaquettes. And we have different choices. The simplest choice, which corresponds to the fact of not having any branch point at all, is that the plaquette has no branch point, but that means that as you go around the plaquette, then the permutation has to be the identity permutation, so it has to be that this Boltzmann weight is just a delta function, and the delta function can be expanded on the base of the characters of the symmetric group in a way which is a standard way. The dr is the dimension of the representation, and we are summing over all the reducible representations. So that's the Boltzmann weight in this particular case. The second case I'm considering is the one where the plaquette has only one quadratic branch point. That means that the as we go, I go around the plaquette, the permutation has to be a transposition, an exchange of two elements. And then again, this is the partition function where the dimension of the representation is replaced by the character of a transposition, which I denote by character of 2, where 2 I mean a permutation with this cycle decomposition. But of course the most general case is the case when the plaquette alpha has the most as a general structure of branch points. So this W alpha R are arbitrary function, and in that case you have any possible choice of branch points. I mean, fixing this function W alpha means fixing the probability structure of any type of branch points occurring. Now, what about solving this, formally solving this theory? Well, the solution of this theory follows exactly the same pattern as the solution of any two-dimensional gauge theory, and is based on the orthogonality and composition properties of the characters, which have I write here. These are written for the symmetric group, but they are exactly the same for the unitary group or any Lie group. And the way it works is that two dimension has this peculiar property that each gauge variable is shared between 2 plaquettes, and so by using this relation here, you can integrate over that variable and eliminate this thing. And you carry on this procedure until, for instance, in the case of a torus, you end up just with a polygon with the opposite side identified. And then you do the last integrations using instead this relation here, and you calculate the partition function. As I say, this is typical of two dimension, doesn't work in higher dimensions. And the result, in the case of no branch points, the theory is purely topological. The partition function depends only on the genus. I mean, what else could it depend on? I mean, there's nothing else, no more information in it, and it's given simply by this this relation. Now, the case I'll be mostly interested on in what follows is the case where you have only quadratic branch point. This A is not an article; it just stands for the number of quadratic points I introduce, so I call A the number of quadratic points. And if you calculate the partition function, it has the same piece as before, but it also has this coefficient here. And I'm also going to call this A area, because it plays exactly the same role as in Young-Mills theory, two-dimensional Young-Mills theory is played by the area. On the other hand, in this kind of things, the area is, I mean, I haven't introduced any metric or anything like that, so the area is anything that is additive. When I put 2 pieces together, the number of branch points doubles, and so on. So I measure the area as the number of branch points. It's an additive parameter in the theory. The other thing I'll be interested in will be in considering, instead of a sphere or a Riemann surface, consider a disk. I fix at the edge of the disk a permutation Q, and I have a fixed number A of branch points, and then the partition function will be the one I wrote down here. Now, that's the formal solutions of these cases. Now, what I want to do, I want to take of these things the limit when the number n, when the order n of the symmetric group goes to infinity. And the reason, originally the reason why we thought of this was because there is some naive arguments why one should expect some non-trivial phase structure as we take that limit. And the argument is the following. Consider the partition function on a disk. The partition function on a disk, I mean, the theory on a disk had a number A of branch points, and then we have a fixed permutation Q here at the border. Now, it's obvious, as each branch point corresponds to a transposition, that if the number of branch points A is smaller than N, smaller than the order of the group, then the partition function is zero if Q is such that it takes more than A exchanges to produce Q. In other words, I don't have enough branch points inside to make up for Q on the border, and so this has to be zero. On the other hand, one naively expects that if the area is much bigger than the order of the group, that in the end we would expect that the partition function doesn't depend anymore from the permutation, from what permutation Q I put on the border, because I've got so many exchanges inside that any permutation can be produced with the same probability. So clearly, at some stage in this process, I have to find a phase transition of some sort. This was the original idea, in fact, that led us to consider this model. And the idea was also somehow... well, here I already wrote down what the result will be. We'll check that as we take the Lagrangian limit, there will be a phase transition, but this phase transition unexpectedly comes not to this big N, should be a small n for consistency, when the number of branch points is equal to 1/2 n log n. So unlikely the standard type of large N theories, here we have an n log n as a in front. And as I say, this was also suggested by the analogy with SUN gauge theory. The situation is different, but presents some similarity. And I'm thinking of the Douglas-Kazakov phase transition. If people are not familiar with the Douglas-Kazakov phase transition, I'll just mention, if you are on a sphere, in the Lagrangian limit, you look at a loop. You consider a point, then you consider a loop like that. Then you can look what the eigenvalue distribution around this loop, and this eigenvalue distribution will be something like this. As the loop gets bigger, the eigenvalues spread more and more, until at one point they reach the value pi. If they reach the value pi before you reach the equator, if you reach the equator before the spreading of the eigenvalues reach the value pi, the distribution of the eigenvalues start from a delta function here, correspondence of the pole. It spreads until a certain point, and then it starts shrinking again until you reach the other pole. But if by the time you get to the equator, this width reaches pi, then you start having a completely different distribution. And so there is a critical area where you have a phase transition. And this is the Douglas-Kazakov phase transition. This is somewhat similar, because if the area is large enough, then you have enough possibilities to create any possible permutation in the game. So the problem now is a technical problem, namely to perform the large n limit of this theory. And as I'm considering only quadratic branch points, then the action I should be looking at is this one here. And the problem is, here you have a sum of the representations. The problem is to find in the large n limit the representation that dominates this sum. And that will give me the solution. Now, the fact is the large n limit of the symmetric group is far from trivial. And the reason why it's far from trivial is that the irreducible representation of the symmetric group are in one-to-one correspondence with a Young tableau which have exactly n boxes. So let me call Ri the length of the rows, Sj the length of the columns, and then of course you have these relations. And for my needs, I only need to calculate the dimension of the representation and the character of a transposition, which are well-known objects in terms of these quantities. But now, what's the difficulty of doing this in the large n limit? Well, the basic difficulty is the following. When you do the large n limit of a standard matrix theory, all you need to do, you have the index I that goes from 1 to n. You take I divided by n, and you call this x. And this x becomes a continuum parameter that as it goes from 0 to 1, your discrete index goes from 1 to n. And all you have to do is to introduce a function which is the density of the eigenvalues for each value of the of x. But here you see you have two indices, I and j, corresponding to the row and the columns of the Young tableau. And what is kept fixed and equal to n is the area. So you have many ways of obtaining something that has area n in the large n limit. And typically, a possible situation, but not necessarily the only situation, is the one where all the rows of the Young tableau scale like n to the alpha, and all the columns scale like n to 1 minus alpha. Then the area is still of order 1. But now I'm going to examine this case, but you have to keep in your mind that you could have different parts scaling with different alphas, or in principle even a continuum distribution of values of alpha. So the situation seems pretty messy. If you start just from the naive hypothesis that there is only one value of alpha, so all rows scale like alpha and all columns scale like one over alpha, then of course the large n limit of the Young tableau is pretty simple. Reasonably simple. You just introduce two continuum variables, one for the rows and one for the columns, dividing the discrete index by n to the alpha and n to 1 minus alpha. Then the length of the rows and the columns define a function f of x. And in the large n limit, your Young tableau is described by a smooth function y equals f of x. And in doing that, you can calculate explicitly what the dimension of the representation and what the character of the transposition look like in terms of this function f. Just something I want to remark here, I introduce this function f, in the end this function will be irrelevant, in the sense that the leading term in both cases, when you in the free energy, this appears under logarithm. And so you see that in here you pick up whichever of these terms is leading, and then the leading term is the one where you take logarithm of n, and the logarithm of f minus x is subleading compared to that, just by a log, but is subleading. And here the same, when you pick up the log of this, you have minus alpha log n, and then a logarithm of this, and this will have a log n that dominates. So the particular structure of this function will be, in the end, will be irrelevant. It will be relevant when we decide, which is what we are trying to do, to go to the next term, which will be not n log n, but simply n. And then this function will be relevant as well.
Is it possible that you have I and j scale like n?
No.
Why is it not?
Because you would end up with a Young tableau whose area grows faster than n.
No, there's a sum add up to 1. That's the fraction. 1 is x, 1 is y, x plus y is 1 all times.
Yeah. In fact, your question comes at the right time for me, because it gives me the chance to tell you something which is not in the transparencies, but anyway, the best way to look at this problem is to start by introducing variables which are log I divided by log n. Let's call me this x, and so write the Young tableau in terms of this logger, where both sides are scaled logarithmically. Then in order to have an area that scales like n, if this is the equation x plus y equal 1, essentially, then your Young tableau is a curve that can do these sort of things, has to stay inside this triangle, and it has to touch this line at most in a discrete set of points. If it doesn't touch this line, the area of the Young tableau would grow slower than n. If it went over this line, it would grow faster than n. And it would grow faster than n even if it did something like this. It came here, did like this, and then came down, so stayed equal to 1 for an interval. It would still go faster than n by a logarithm. So that's also ruled out. And that's why, in the end, the case I just showed you before, the one where the rows and columns scale by a power alpha, is an important one, because at most to the leading term you'll have a finite number of alphas, and you'll have different sections of the Young tableau, each one scaling with a different alpha, but you have at most a finite set of alphas. And that's what makes the calculation possible, because in the end the dimension of the representation is dominated, is bigger when both rows and columns scale like 1 to the half. Whereas the character of the transposition is bigger when you have a subdiagram consisting just in one row or one column. And then in the end of the game, the only surviving diagrams are diagrams made like this in the large and limit. They are made by one row or column of length z times n, where z is between 0 and 1, and then a triangle here where both sides scale instead like n to the half. And this is something of area Zn, and the triangle has area 1 minus z times n.
So what kind of permutations are those? Are there ones with large numbers of sets?
Well, here I can see what representations are dominant. I can't really tell what permutation is dominant, except that I know, and you'll see later, that the situation where you only have one row or one column corresponds to the situation where all permutations are equally probable. I don't know exactly what this scaly by square roots of n actually mean in terms of permutation, I mean. So in the end of the game, what happens is that you can calculate exactly the free energy in terms of this parameter z, which is the parameter that tells you how much of the one row diagram and how much of the square root scaling diagram there is. And so this is the partition function, and you can see that the area A, the number of quadratic branch points, if you want to match these terms, has to be of order n log n. I call small n the coefficient, and then I get something like this. And then to find the leading diagram, what you have to do is to extremize with respect to the value of z, keeping in mind so that z has to be between 0 and 1. And it's easy to find. The maximum has this value. And so you have two different situations. If A is smaller than a half, then the extreme value for z is 1 minus 2a, and this is what I call phase 1. In this phase, the leading diagram is a mixture of is a one row plus a triangle with scaling as like a square root. And in the other phase, instead, the extreme corresponds to 1, and here you have only just one row. The leading diagram, or one column. Now, what's the meaning? In particular, now we'd be interested to know what the order parameters of this. Clearly, there is a phase transition here, and one can ask the question of what the order parameter would be. I mean, what does this transition mean in terms of coverings? Presumably, with something related, as we'll see, whether the covering is connected or is not connected, and things like that. But
does that relate to something nice in the gauge theory?
No, that is just the mix, the ratio of the mixture of these two sections of the. Now, but before going into that, I just want to introduce a more general model. A more general model depends on an additional parameter x. And what is x? Well, you see here in A is still the number of plaquettes. So, loosely speaking, is still the area. But now each plaquette has a probability x of having a quadratic branch point and the probability 1 minus x of not having any branch point. So now I'm allowing also a situation where when I add a new plaquette, it can have or it cannot have a branch point with probability x. And one can repeat the same kind of argument, of course, and the previous model corresponds to x equal 1. But there is also an interesting limit when x goes to 0 and A is taken proportional to x. This is a kind of continuum limit that leads to this type of partition function, which is very, very similar to the partition function of Young-Mills theories, where you have this exponent and the area, and here instead of this character, there is the Casimir of the. Of the group. But anyway, if you carry on the same type of analysis, now it's better I cut these details a bit short, what you end up with is a phase structure of this type. You see, one naively, when we started this game of adding these extra plaquettes with nothing in, we thought that the result would be just trivially, you add a lot of things that have got nothing, and so in the end, okay, we'll, instead of finding the transition function at 1/2, we'll have the transition function at 1/2x, because you just diluted the branch points with a lot of stuff that hasn't got anything. And instead, no, because there is some entropy factor involved when you introduce these things. And so you find, in fact, if this is X and this is A, a structure like this with three distinct regions. These two, the previous case was here, so phase one and phase two where the leading diagram is only one row. This where there is a mixture of one row and a little triangle. What's phase three? Well, phase three is when the leading Young tableau is a tableau where with only rows and columns scaling by n to the 1/2. So that's this region here. And everything can be calculated explicitly. These are the analytic equations for these three lines of transition here. And notice that this line here is just 1/2x. So it's what one would have expected according to the naive argument that you just dilute the branch points, and so instead of having the phase transition at 1/2, you have it at 1/2x. But it only holds up to a certain point, and then there is some new phenomenon occurring, and you enter this new region here. Now, let's go back to discussing what the order parameter of and trying to interpret physically what this transition mean. We found it impossible to calculate what they mean by straightforward calculations, basically because any further information you want on correlations, on things like that, involve not only the n log n order, but also the n order without the log. And so that's why now we are trying to solve the problem of finding the next order, because that would lead a lot of extra information. So we wouldn't have known anything about the exact meaning of these three phases if it hadn't been for the fact that I'm going to show in a minute, but I anticipate here the result. If it hadn't been for the fact that we managed to prove the equivalence between this gauge theory of the symmetric group and random walks on the symmetric group. And someone else, I forgot the names now, had proven recently also the relation between the equivalence between what is called cutoff phenomena in random walks, which means I'll show you in a minute what it means, and phase transition in random graphs. And so in the end, the problem of what the meaning is of these phase transitions here is related to phase transition in random graphs, and those have been extensively studied. And so these results are taken from the literature, mainly there are works from Erdos, forgot the other name, with a sort of a warning. Results in random graphs and in random walks always correspond to what in our case would be a disk. And the reason is clear. I mean, from the point of view of a random walk, it's much easier to leave an open boundary condition, leave it open where the walker ends his walk. Instead, a closed Riemann surface, from the point of view of the random walks, means to impose that the walker ends up to the same point, which from the point of view of random walks is a much more difficult problem. Instead, for us, it is an easier problem, because it just means studying closed Riemann surfaces. So all these results were derived with open boundary condition, and in order to apply them to our situation, one has to do a little bit of tricks. And so in the end, I think that these results are rigorous, except that they are rigorous not necessarily in the whole region, but for instance in this region we can tell something above the point one and not underneath. But as long as there is no other hidden phase transition in between, then we can extend it everywhere. The reason is that in order to say something on a sphere starting from a disk, you have to take two disks and put them together, and then you double the area, basically. And that's so with this warning, I can tell you what the meaning of these phases are. Now, phase two, which is the one which was the further one up. Hang on, maybe. Phase two is this one here. That phase is characterized by the fact that in the large end limit, the world sheet is completely connected. Any two sheets are, you have a way to get from any sheet to any other sheet. That's easy. Phase one, the one here, is a phase where which is characterized by the following property. Let me call NC the dimension of the largest connected part of the world sheet. Okay? Then the limit for n going to infinity of NC divided by n is equal to 1. So there is a large part of the world sheet which is in fact of, in the large end limit exactly of order 1, which is connected. But there are also...
So this means that the permutation denominator has cycles that are almost as...
Yeah, basically, yes.
And where it's completely connected, it means that the permutation is...
No, sorry. If you are on a disk... Completely connected means that any permutation has the same probability of occurring at the edge. Because you see, the fact that it's completely connected doesn't mean necessarily that at the border you get the cyclic permutation. Instead, what it means, you can get anything with the same probability. But unlike phase two, in the phase one, the one down here, there are some disconnected parts. And in fact, you can even calculate how many disconnected parts of area one, so sheets which are just left there on their own, isolated, there are. And there is a number n0, which is of the order of n to 1 minus 2xa. And it's clear that there is a phase transition again when A is equal to 1 over 2x, which is exactly the phase transition that we described down there. Now, what about phase 3, which is the large area here? Well, phase 3 All we can say of phase 3 is that if, again, NC is the largest connected part, the limit when of NC over N is less than 1. But could even be 0, which leaves open the question of whether in that region there are further phase transitions. Because you see, you could start from the value 1 for this limit as you go across the boundary of the phase transition line, and then go gradually down to 0 and have another phase transition when it reaches the point 0. But presumably this phase transition is not in the n log n, actually it's certainly not in the n log n term, but is in the term proportional to only to n. And that's, in some respect, logical, because you see that something wrong here. Because you see that this region here, in the situation where you have one branch point for every plaquette, corresponds just to this point here. And this point here corresponds to a situation where the coefficient of n log n is 0. And so the leading term is n. So adding this empty plaquette is a way to having also an area where the effective number of branch points is proportional to n and not to n log n. Right, I've almost gone through this part here. Now what I would just very briefly summarize the connection between partition function on a disk and the random walk. This is the easy way of seeing it, and then there is a more formal way of seeing it, which I won't discuss, but this correspondence is we discovered is completely general. I mean, any gauge theory can be seen as a random walk on the corresponding group manifold, essentially. Now, let me discuss it in this simple case. You have a partition function on a disk. We take the model with x equal 1, so each plaquette has a transposition, corresponds to a transposition. Now, we use what, in loose language, you can call area preserving diffeomorphisms, which here means that you can rearrange your plaquettes the way you want, as long as the number of branch points is kept the same. And so we arrange the situation in this way, like a kind of bicycle wheel. I wouldn't recommend anyone to ride on the bicycle with those sort of wheels. But and then you can choose your gauging variants to fix all the links corresponding to the radius of the bicycle fixed to the unity. Then as each plaquette corresponds to a transposition, what you are left, you're left with the transpositions on the radial links. And so T1, T2, TP are P transpositions. And so if you want to calculate the partition function on a disk with a fixed Q on the edge, what you have to do, you have to impose that T1 times T2, etc., times TP is equal Q. And counting the coverings that satisfy that condition means counting in how many ways you can construct Q by multiplying P transpositions. But that's exactly another way of saying that what you do, you have a random walk on the group manifold of the, well, it's not a manifold, on the on the group Sn, where you start from the identity, and each time you move in a random way by a transposition, and you want, you impose that in the end, you end up on the permutation Q. So calculating this probability of random walks and calculating the partition function on disk is the same thing. And this can be done in an absolutely general, I mean, this is a very specific case. You could do it with any sort of walk. I mean, I don't have time now to relay the details, but the partition function on the disk always has this interpretation in terms of random walks. And so after we discovered that, we looked at the results that were known in on random walks on SN, and we discovered that these two people from Stanford, Diaconis and Shahshavani, had proved that in a random walk where the walker can do a random transposition at each step, which is exactly our case with x equal 1, the one examined at the beginning, after 1/2 n log n steps, there is a cutoff phenomenon, which means that the walker loses any recognition of the starting point, which means that on the disk, any permutation becomes equally probable. And finally, the last bit of the game, we discovered that in 2001, so just last year, Pak and Wu established a correspondence between cutoff phenomena in random walks and phase transition in random graphs. There is a naive explanation of this. I mean, it's not rigorous, but it explains roughly why is that. Suppose I represent the different sheets with these points here. What does it mean when I have a branch point? It means that I establish a link between one sheet and another sheet, because I can go from one to the other through the branch point. And so adding branch points means adding links. So what I'm doing, I'm constructing a random graph on these n points. I say it's naive, because when I introduce branch points, I sew together two sheets. But then if I introduce a branch point from a third sheet to one of these two, it's not so clear whether how I name all these different sheets, because if I go around, the two sheets exchanges, and so also the name exchanges, and so it's not as trivial as that. Otherwise, wouldn't have taken up to the year 2001 to establish the connection. But this is roughly explains why the things are related. And it is on this theory of random graphs that one can find all this information that I used to characterize the different phases of our gauge theory. I've just about finished. I didn't have time to discuss the relation with the matrix models. I'm just telling you as a conclusion, which is the only conclusion I can say, that the interesting part from this point of view would be to go to the next order, because there where a lot of interesting information is, including the possibility of further phase transitions in that third region down here, which from the point of view of random graphs corresponds to the percolation threshold. So that there are a lot of things connected to each other, and so that's all.